Today is Tuesday, the 27th of August, 1996. I am James Briggs Murray, sitting on the stage of the Langston Hughes Auditorium of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library, and having the pleasure to welcome back to this stage Marion McPartland.
It's nice to be back.
Yes.
I've enjoyed the times I've spent here very much.
And you've been here in a couple of different capacities. But we'll get into that a little later on.
Okay.
I want to first mention that we're here as part of what the Schomburg Center has been doing as the Louis Armstrong Jazz Oral History Project, in which we are seeking to get on the historical record some of the personal recollections of some of the masters, by some of the masters, and in the hopes that generations of young folks and older folks and people familiar with the music and people trying to become familiar with the music will learn a lot from the mouths of those who have been the creators of it. And you certainly qualify in that area. But I have to start, like it or not, by asking you when and where you were born.
It's written up in so many books, you know, they keep pounding away at how old you are. And I really have developed this feeling that all jazz musicians should be ageless. Imagine trying to pin an age on Duke Ellington. I just think it's obscene. So I'm going to go along with your other person that wouldn't reveal his age, so you may have to go and look it up.
All right. Well, we know
okay.
It.
Go and look it up. It's just that I hate it to pass my lips because because I feel so vigorous and full of vim, and you know, to actually mumble this figure about when I was born. I can tell you where. It was in a place called Slough, which is near Windsor, England, and all my relatives were from that area. So, anyway, that's close enough, James.
All right. Well, when we catalog this tape, of course, we will put that correct date in.
Oh, you can do that.
We won't even make mention of the fact that you didn't want the date to pass your lips.
No, there's something obscene about it to me. It sort of puts you somewhere you don't want to be.
Would you be upset at me if it passed my lips?
Oh, I'd hate that too.
Oh, you would. All right, then
yeah,
I won't mention it.
Great.
We'll just put it in our cataloging notes.
Okay, fine.
But if one were to hear it, they would probably wonder if either your memory were at fault or their calculations, their ability to calculate, were at fault, because it's hard to imagine that you've reached whatever that age happens to be. I agree that that people should be considered ageless, especially people who have been creators. And as you mentioned, Ellington, something else that is very difficult to categorize is the music itself. Ellington, as you may know,
yes,
Didn't like the term jazz. He just called it the music of Duke Ellington.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I can remember sitting there and hearing him pontificating about that very thing. So I know only too well.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that most of your relatives were from that Windsor region in England. I thought I read somewhere that you had an uncle or someone who was at some point the mayor of Windsor. Is that correct?
That's true. He actually, if I'm going to discuss the family tree, I think he really wasn't an uncle. He was like a second cousin.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, as kids, you always call these older people uncle or auntie or whatever. And I always called him Uncle Cyril. And he was indeed the mayor of Windsor, and I have pictures of him. He had a wonderful jewelry store right opposite Windsor Castle. And I can remember being in there one time when Princess Elizabeth, who was then about 12 or 11, came to the store there with her father, who was then King of England. And my sister and I were hustled into the back of the shop so that we wouldn't be in the way or disturb anybody while they bought whatever they'd come in for. And later, when Elizabeth was queen, she knighted Cyril, Uncle Cyril. You know, one of those things that you read about in fairy tales, knighted him in the street with the sword, you know, and arise, Sir Cyril. I'd love to have been there, because it just sounds unbelievable.
But you weren't there?
No, I wasn't there. I think I was here.
Oh, I see. By that time. Yeah,
but,
I see. Now, did you have many people in your family who were musicians or who had a great appreciation for music?
Well, this particular branch of the family, like Cyril's father, their name was Dyson, and there were these different brothers. I'm going to get mixed up if I'm not careful. Cyril's father was Harry Dyson, and he did play an instrument. And there were a couple of other brothers. They had a music store. They all played like in a local orchestra. Mm-hmm. And one of them, I should come up with all the names, but offhand
not,
I can't.
It's not that
and one of them was a singer in St. George's Chapel, which is part of Windsor Castle. And they had this wonderful chorus. And whenever the king or queen were in residence, he would sing in the chorus. And so because of this, I never could figure out why. My grandmother had a house inside the castle grounds. It was a little area called the Cloisters. And I remember going there to this cute little house, almost like a doll's house. So you can see that I was sort of actively involved with this end of the family. In fact, Uncle Harry, as I then called him, and his wife, Aunt Frances, they had a piano in their living room, and I think that might have been one of the first times I played
on about the piano. How old were you at that point, roughly? How old were you at that point? I won't ask you what year it was.
It's all right. No, please don't. I was about 3,
uh-huh.
Or maybe less, and I had probably already played on my mother's piano in the house, or tried to play to imitate her, because she played rather nice piano. And anyway, I guess I was in Windsor for a visit, and I remember full well playing on this ancient upright, which had candle sconces and all the things you think about with it, like a satin inlet on the front of the piano. And it probably wasn't a very good piano, but I remember playing it and feeling delighted that I could do this and having them encourage me. And
what were you playing, do you recall? If you
I don't know what I played, but probably it could have been probably the first thing I remember playing was a Chopin waltz that my mother used to play.
And that's still in the area, the age range of 3, 4?
Yeah, around in there. I mean, I can leap up and play that thing, if you like, a little bit of it.
Sure.
Do you want to hear it?
Do you want to
I mean, this is probably my first memory of actually playing piano.
I'd love to hear a little piece of that. Let's see if you're
Oops.
Tied in here.
I am. Well, maybe I can...
Then let me just take this off. And we'll put that back on when you come back.
It's got a long cord. If I do this again, I can maybe trail along with it. This is short. I mean, it's...
Yes. Just
a touch.
Yes. Lovely.
Of course, it's much more, but you don't want to hear yes. the whole thing.
But it's not often that you get someone to play something that they recall playing at the age of three.
Well, there are some things that are very strong in my mind. And that's one of them, maybe because... Gee, I really wore the wrong clothes today. Oops, excuse me. Maybe because it was such a something I wanted to do so badly, and hearing Mummy play that thing.
Now, your mother played piano. She played classical music, I presume?
Yes, rather strictly from the music. I mean, she...
She wasn't improvising at all.
No, she just had these books, which I still have all these years later, with Chopin Nocturnes and... I mean, I play some of them, but even when I went to study music at the Guildhall, I never really got into big repertoire of tunes.
Now, did your father play at all, any instrument?
No.
Yeah, I presume he appreciated your mother's playing?
I guess he did. I don't remember him saying anything about it. He liked to walk through the house singing. He would sing in church, and he would sing kind of semi-comedy. There was a song at that time years ago called Come Into the Garden, Maud. I can play it on the piano, I can't sing it. Come Into the Garden, Maud. The black bat night has flown. Isn't that
so
funny?
So he enjoyed himself quite a bit.
Oh yeah, he had a nice baritone and he would just sort of sing these sort of... what was probably some aria, and he would sing it with kind of a humorous bent to it.
So in many ways, you were in a musical environment. You had the family with a music store, you had these cousins and uncles who played instruments, your mother was a pianist,
right.
Your father would stroll through the house singing.
I think I'm going to sneeze. I hate to do this.
That's quite all right.
I'm sorry. Don't include this. Or maybe I headed it off. I could feel it coming on. Unfortunately, the old allergy kicked up today.
Well, I've been hearing many people complaining about it.
Oh, it's terrible. Anyway, for the moment, I'm not going to sneeze.
Yeah. When you're in the dog days of August, this is one of the things you have to live with sometimes.
See, you're making me realize these things. I never thought about it as being any sort of a musical environment. Really think about it.
You wouldn't necessarily, because it was just your natural environment. But it's always curious to me to know, when someone has done so much with music in their life, to what extent might they have been in that kind of environment from their early years. And clearly you were. Doesn't mean that you necessarily would have evolved into someone with great musical talent and also as an educator, but it turns out that you did. Now, you mentioned the school that you went to. When did you first go to a music school?
Oh, that wasn't until I was about 17.
Oh, 17? Is that the Golson School? What's the name
Guildhall
of the school?
Guildhall School of Music.
How would you spell that? I don't...
Guildhall, it's all one word. G-U-I-L-D-H-A-L-L. Guildhall School of Music. It was a very pretty prestigious school, probably close to the Royal... Royal College of Music was one. There were two or three top music schools.
Was the Guildhall School in Windsor or in London?
No, this was in London.
In London.
This didn't come till later in my life, but because I just always played. Actually, what happened, I was a kid that would like to have taken piano lessons.
So you had...
I didn't have any, because my mother would say to me things like, oh no, dear, you have violin fingers, you should study the violin. So they took me out and bought a violin. I didn't really want to do this necessarily, but you know, one did what one was told.
But did that include taking any violin lessons?
Yes.
It did?
Yes.
And you didn't like it?
Well, I liked not as much as piano, because the teacher was lovely. I liked her very much. Her name was Edith Jarvis. And all the time I was taking lessons with her, I was saying to her, I'd like to take piano lessons. And she would sort of promise, well, in a year or two, we'll see if you can take piano lessons. But meanwhile, I was just playing everything that I could hear, tunes at school. I started out in the first school in the kindergarten, like with things the teacher would play, nursery rhymes, and just everything I know by ear. Anyway, unfortunately, Miss Jarvis died. And so a student of hers was elected to teach me the violin, and I didn't like her. I remember all these names, it's amazing. Her name was Eleanor Izzard, I-Z-Z-A-R-D. I've never heard that name before or since.
Izzard.
Yeah, and she was very nice. I remember her, can remember her quite well. She was very nice, and she probably didn't know what the hell to do with me, and I think I sort of rebelled and said, well, I'm not enjoying this. I didn't do much rebelling, but I remember sort of confronting her and saying, I'm not happy with this. And so that was the end of the violin lessons.
Well, were you telling her that you weren't happy with her or with the violin? Or
no, with the violin. I can't remember exactly what I did, but it was probably very mild because we never did anything to people in authority. We weren't allowed to do that, you know.
So you really didn't like the violin. It's just that you liked Miss Jarvis so much that you accommodated the
yes,
the
really,
forced
really,
lessons.
That was true. And she had me perform a couple of concerts, but I just wasn't a natural good violinist. Could never get a good vibrato, and I have a very good ear. So if I didn't play in tune, it would drive me crazy. Mm. I just never got very far with the violin, really.
So now, from the time of that period, kindergarten years and so on, up until you went to the Guildhall School in London at the age of 17, what did you do musically?
Well,
that's about a 10-year
stretch or so. Mostly playing by ear, and then there was a local, another teacher that sort of came to the house and gave me a few lessons.
And that's her name piano? Piano lessons?
Piano lessons, uh-huh. Now. Just a few. And her name was Gwen Massey, mm-hmm. And I took part in local music festivals and
any recitals?
No recitals. Just like music competitions.
I see.
Most of which I won or placed high in, but never thought of myself as somebody. You know, I was always thinking, well, I guess I got by with that. But I was, you know, I loved the piano. I could play all day. And during this period, I was in various schools. I mean, you don't want to go into that because we moved a couple of times.
Yeah. And were you thinking of yourself as a person who would eventually become a professional musician later in life?
No, I was just a total drifter. I didn't know what I was going to do. I was sort of like involved with the whatever school I was in, and I liked being outdoors, and I loved gardening, and that was something my father was really into, and through him, and I really developed a love of all the things that a lot of people hate, like cutting hedges and pulling up weeds and all those things. I find all those things very therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And anyway, just to sort of cut it short, I finally wound up when I was about 15, I think. I had gone to a convent school. Oh, I remembered what happened. My mother threatened to take me away from the convent school because the nuns said I was badly behaved. And I guess I was sort of a slight cut up, you know, would like to be funny, but nothing really, really bad. But anyway, she kept saying, oh, we're going to take you away from the convent and send you to boarding school. Mm. So this, in fact, happened, a school called Stratford House. And I was so unhappy there, being in boarding school, that I developed terrible headaches, like migraines. Mm. And the doctor said, well, you better take her away from that school. So I went there as a day student. And then I was all right. It's funny how things can affect you. I never dreamed that that's what it was until later on. But meanwhile, I was playing piano for all the kids. That was my one claim to fame, was playing piano and learning pop tunes of the day. And
so you weren't playing classical necessarily for them? You were
no.
Playing mostly pop tunes?
I was playing pop things, and I was hearing all the jazz on the BBC. And I mean, I didn't know what was jazz and what was pop. And I mean, I just learned tunes,
yeah,
regardless of whether it would be St. Louis Blues or it would be some popular tune of the day written by Cole Porter. I just learned tunes, and thank God I still remember them. Because I
do
just,
you remember some of the, any particular people that might have sounded good to you at that time, hearing them on the BBC? Or really was just the tunes at that time?
Oh, a lot of people. And I remember something, well, I guess when I was in my teens, people would come to England to perform, like Fats Waller,
yeah,
and Duke Ellington. I remember them being in clubs and being there. And it just never occurred to me that I could ever go there and hear them. All I heard was on the BBC or recordings. I started to develop a huge recording collection. And I had a boyfriend who was really into jazz. His name was Ken Hughes, and I'll always be grateful to him because he probably was one person that really interested me in jazz, bringing over his records and saying, listen to this and listen to this, and do you hear what so-and-so is doing? And so I had a really quite a group of recordings from Muggsy Spanier and Bud Freeman to Sidney Bechet to Duke, of course, Benny Goodman, Lionel Hampton, everything at Art Tatum, everything I could lay my hands on, Teddy Wilson, and listening avidly to all this stuff.
Now, when you did go to the Guildhall School at the age of 17, was the focus then on classical music?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. And I felt that I wanted to try to catch up with things that I hadn't learned before, like good fingering and technique. And
technique,
I'd never
yes.
had any really formal, serious study, and this was it, like from all day, every day. And my teacher's name of professor was, oh, first of all, I'm telling you things that may not be that important. The teacher at Stratford House, my father enlisted her aid, saying to her, I wasn't around at the time, what shall we do with her? This was me, obviously. I was not conforming to what they wanted. And so this teacher said, well, you should have her study music. She should go to a music school. And I don't know what else was said, but anyway, that I had some talent. So I auditioned at the Guildhall, and the head of the school was a very noted conductor, Sir Landon Ronald. And I remember going to seeing him quaking in my boots. And anyway, I took the audition, I went to the school, I took piano, composition, and as a second instrument, violin. But again, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Quit that pretty soon.
Did everyone have to have a second instrument? Was that a requirement to have a second
yes.
instrument?
Yes.
Uh-huh. So it may as well have been the violin, I suppose.
I suppose. I
since you'd already
anyway, I didn't like the teacher again, so I dropped it. I see a pattern of behavior here. And then I also took singing lessons, which is sort of amazing to me, because I've had a little piping voice. In fact, my husband, Jimmy, if I ever tried to sing, he says, oh, you sound like a little English schoolgirl, which probably is very true. So I've never tried to sing. Anyway, I'd better stop and let you guide me along with what
well,
I want to hear.
Fine. When you got to the Guildhall School, that was very good in many respects, because even though you were going into classical music, you were going to now learn technique, you were going to learn a lot of the technical things that you had kind of missed over the years.
Right.
But you had demonstrated enough of a talent so that people were enthusiastic about your going to the school. It's ironic that they wanted you to go to the school as somewhat as a disciplinary measure. I mean, put you into something that would harness your energies and cool you out a little bit, I guess. But what are your recollections of that school? And how long were you in that school, by the way?
About 3 years. Uh-huh. Well, I mean, it was like an academy. I would travel up to London every day from... At that point, we were living in Bromley, Kent. Mm-hmm. I would take the train and spend probably the whole day there. Then I would come home. I think I went there most days in the week. And then I would come home and practice. In fact, I remember my father saying to my mother something like, "What's the matter with her? All she does is play all day, she comes home and practices, then she goes to bed." Hmm. And which was pretty much true. I didn't really have much of a teenage life because I was really into practicing everything, and I would practice 8 hours a day.
So you really loved the instrument and you loved the music.
I guess I did.
Yeah.
Or it was a combination of wanting to play the various things that Mr. Morgan had given me. And I mean, it would be, there would be like exercises and scales and certain pieces with Bach fugues or some Beethoven or then there would be composition to write a piece. I've got a lot of these. I still have a lot of these pieces that I wrote at that time.
Hmm.
They're really not bad. Or not too bad. And
these are classical pieces that you wrote at that time.
Yeah, or songs set to lyrics.
Hmm.
It was an interesting time, but throughout all of this, I was competing for some scholarships there. I did get a couple of scholarships. It's funny, the names of these things. I got one. The Worshipful Company of Musicians was the title of one.
The Worshipful Company of Musicians?
Yes.
A title of one of your creations?
No, this was a scholarship.
Oh, the scholarship.
It was about £10. It wasn't a lot of money.
I see.
And anyway, throughout this whole period, I was noodling around with all the thing. I was playing jazz in the practice room and trying all the things I was doing. I was still listening to all my things at home.
So now you were able to apply the technique that you were learning in this training, being at the Guildhall School, to some of the popular music that you also loved. I mean, I presume that you had an appreciation for both the classical and the popular music.
Yes, but that's true, but I think that jazz was sort of getting the edge, really, because there were so many things I was trying to do, like play runs like Teddy Wilson and play stride piano like Fats Waller, and I was, all these things I was trying to do to imitate. And one day I was in the practice room noodling around playing something, and Mr. Morgan came to the door. I guess that the door was ajar, or at any rate, he heard what I was doing. He opened the door and said, "Stop playing that trash." So I was sort of embarrassed, but only for a minute. I mean, it didn't stop me at all. In fact, I think that might have been the beginning of the end, because I had wanted so badly to play well, jazz, I mean. And there was a guy, I don't know why I picked this person, maybe because he was very accessible. His name was Billy Mayerl, M-A-Y-E-R-L, and he was kind of a pop pianist, not a jazz pianist, although there was some jazz in his playing. And he was very popular at the time as a composer and pianist, and he had a music school. So I decided I would go there and see what he could do for me as far as improving my jazz playing. And as a matter of fact, he did help and in sort of telling me how to play the melody so you don't lose the melody play in the, oh, different things, like play in the same octave, don't play half of the melody down low and then go up to the top of the piano, different things. And the tune was, didn't realize it was been such an old tune. Where Are You? Are you familiar with that tune? So I can get up and play it if you
where
like.
Where Are You? Where Have You Gone Without Me?
Yeah, right.
I
Lovely
thought you
tune.
Cared about me.
Exactly.
Yes. You want to play a little take
sure.
on that? Sure. Let's see, we'll do this again.
Gee, this
Maybe
may take all day.
I'll adjust that so that you won't have to.
Do you have any advice for me? Like, should I not talk so long?
Oh, no. My advice to you is just keep on doing what you're doing.
Oh, okay.
Which is,
because, you
which
know,
is fine.
I can sort of take a breath and let you ask me. I would love to be able to still sit there and illustrate, like, how I played it at the time, because now I play it a lot better than I did when I was playing for Billy Mayo some 50 years ago, whatever it was.
Well, we don't want to mention years.
Oh, well, I don't, I mean, I'll mention a few. I just don't want to pinpoint it, anything. So,
that's such a beautiful song, you know.
Isn't it?
As I was, I'm going to be 49 shortly.
Oh, you're a youngster.
In a matter of weeks.
Just a kid.
But I've listened to music from the time I was very, very young. And I started collecting records at the age of about 7 or 8. I didn't even have a record player yet, but I would go out and buy these 45s. But I was amazed, as I look back on it now, I realized that a lot of the songs that I liked were the standards that were being reissued by the then rhythm and blues artists, some of the pop artists of that time, of the 50s, the mid-50s. And that's one, that was done later on by Patti LaBelle.
What, that song?
Yeah, she did a beautiful rendition of that.
I know.
And that's how I first heard it, but then I realized it wasn't new, it was a standard that had been out for decades, and so I then started to appreciate different ways of doing those songs, and I hope that our generation today gets to appreciate the standards, because not that they shouldn't have the new forms of music that are happening, but there should be some appreciation for the standards and the various ways that you can take those compositions and put your own flavor to it.
I keep wishing some of these people, like Lionel Richie, would take a Duke Ellington tune. And I think, why doesn't he do that? It would mean so much to a whole other group of people, and it would do something for Duke's music that maybe some of these kids listening haven't the faintest idea.
And it would introduce a lot of people to that music who don't know anything about it.
Yeah,
and maybe they won't even make the connection with Ellington, but they'll certainly get to hear some great music.
It's funny. Now, I heard, maybe a couple of years ago, Patty Austin did a recording of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, and she did it in sort of a soft rock arrangement. It was really beautiful, the way she did it, and I was going to call her up. And in fact, I thought, well, maybe someday I'll get her on Piano Jazz.
That would be quite an interesting program.
Yeah, so I'm thinking about that. But anyway, it's so would be so easy to take some of these beautiful tunes and do them in another way. Kern or Duke Ellington, all these people that had beautiful songs, Harold Arlen.
Yeah.
There's so much music, and I mean, I feel that the kids that don't hear that are missing out. I feel as if they just don't know they're being shortchanged.
Well, I agree.
And thank God for Wynton Marsalis and some of these people that are trying to introduce them to the music.
Well, I've always felt that Wynton Marsalis's trumpet was more important, was less important as a performance instrument than it is as an instrument that is heralding a whole new generation into the world of music that they have missed. For him to tell young people, because they see him as being very hip,
yeah.
And for him to tell young people, pay attention to Louis Armstrong, pay attention to Ellington and all of these people, is extraordinary, because they may never have paid attention to those folks at all.
No, but the fact that he is telling them,
yeah.
Then it makes it okay to do that.
And then they find out that he, when he does his series, his PBS series that he's doing now, and then of course all the work he's doing at Lincoln Center, and he shows classical music, or what some people will say is European classical music as opposed to American classical music, which some people like to call jazz. And he'll take those melodies and take the same instrument and show them what can be done. The fact that he is young and he is considered hip, that he is able to bring a generation of people into a world that they would otherwise probably never have known, I think is extraordinarily important. And on the other hand, as you mentioned, it's a pretty sad thing for those people who end up missing it, because it is a beautiful, brilliant world of music that they don't get to find out about. Now, when you, at some point around that time, did you start performing for, there's something in England that's similar to the USO. Did you work in something of that
I
sort?
I did. I just have to go back to the Guildhall for a
sure.
minute. Of course, I was doing, while I was there, I was doing their, like, in-house recitals and things. I was doing that. So I was really doing quite well there.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to see Billy Mayo and spent this time with him, he immediately offered me a job playing with a four-piano act that he was going to form and take out in vaudeville theaters all over the country.
Mm.
And I immediately got very excited, and I decided I just had to do this, so I went home and told this to my parents, who of course were extremely worried, skeptical, everything. In fact, my father even came up to London to see Billy, went and had an interview, met him, and like, how much you're going to pay my daughter, and how are you going to treat her, and how are you going to take care of her, and all this kind of stuff. But Billy probably must have laughed. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I went. And with great promises that I'd go back to the Guildhall and I would finish getting whatever degrees I was supposed to get. I made all these promises that I would go back. And I went out playing in vaudeville theaters. Well, to my parents, when I think of it now, I mean, it was really an awful thing for me to do. I mean, they, in terms of what they expected of me, my father would have liked me to be a nurse or somebody in a bank or something they considered nice, proper, or of course to get married. One of my uncles was always saying, well, when are you going to get married, Margaret? You know, so they always do this. When are you going to get married? Well, I didn't even see the possibility of that. And anyway, doing what I did with this, it was called Billy Mayo and His Claviers, C-L-A-V-I-E-R-S.
Mm-hmm.
And it was four pianos, and he had this extravagant golden grand piano. And the rest of us, the other three of us, had uprights. It was myself and a woman named Dorothy Carlis, who was a very famous band singer in England.
And C-A-R-L-I-S?
C-A-R-L-E-S-S.
L-E-S-S.
She's still around, living in California, and I speak to her once in a while.
Hmm.
The other person was a gentleman named George Middleton, a good piano player, like a very good piano player. So we played with this group all over the country, and it was a top group in terms of, I mean, now that I think of it, I mean, vaudeville was a very potent form of entertainment at that time. People would come to the Empire in Glasgow and the Empire in Edinburgh, and there were theatres in various parts of London, and I must have played in all of them, and I wish I had known that I would like to have tried to write something and describe some of these places, because probably now they're parking lots. Mm. Some of them had beautiful velvet seats and curtains, and they were things that should be landmark theaters. Anyway, you were mentioning USO. Eventually, Billy's group disbanded after about, I'm not sure, a year, 2 years. We recorded Subsides for English Decca, which are still around, and boy, did they sound funny to me. Ricky Ticky. And I really didn't know how to organize my life. I really didn't know. I tried different things. I played two pianos with a woman pianist, like in the pit of a theater doing a play. I did all kinds of things like that. Anyway, when the war came, they were calling up women for the army, and it was good. I was going to get called up to be in the women's army unless I would do something in the entertainment world. So I did. I joined what was called ENSA, Entertainment National Service Organization.
So that was the British equivalent of the USO.
Yes. Then. And we played all over the country for the troops. And then one of my friends from vaudeville days said to me, she was a singer, "Oh, why don't you join USO? You could go to, you know, and you'll meet all these exciting Americans, and, you know, that sounded interesting." So I did that, joined USO camp shows, and we played in some for the troops in England. Then they wanted us to go to France right after the invasion in 1944. And we went about a month after the invasion, myself and a group of, like, a comedian, a singer, a dancer, myself on piano, and I think they had a guitar player. I mean, it wasn't really well thought out musically. And at that time, I had to learn the accordion because they thought there wouldn't be enough pianos over there, that sometime I would have to play accordion. Mm. So, not wanting to at all, I learned to play just enough accordion to get by. But as luck would have it, I never had to play it, because they always had like a little GI piano. They were like a spinet, not all that long, just a small army-type spinet. And so it was a very exciting time. We went all through France and saw this terrible devastation. I mean, it was almost sinful to be seeing all this and be involved in it, and yet having a really good time playing. And all the people we played for loved it. Of course, they were starved for entertainment. I've got pictures of us out there on some improvised stage, performing for like thousands of troops sitting out in a field. And we would visit hospitals, and of course we were, for the most part, we were in tents. We had to learn how to help put up a tent, and we would, it was sort of rough in the beginning.
And you, what kind of music were you playing for the most part? Were you playing jazz and pop music for them?
I was trying to play some jazz, but I think I was mostly playing sort of pop tunes of the day. Mm-hmm. They had all these wartime tunes. "Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree." I remember playing that for the girl singer. And there were a lot of, I guess mostly standard tunes that people would do. Mm-hmm. And then I would do some kind of piano solo combination of, I know this sounds silly, but they had this tune that was very popular called Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition.
Yes.
And I made a sort of symphonic arrangement of that and then played it, sort of tried to swing it. And, you know, I guess I did very stupid things in those days. And
but I presume it was well received.
Well, it was well received. I mean, they were so eager to hear some playing and singing. And you know, then we had a girl juggler. We had all these people. And here we are in Belgium, and it's getting to be end of the year. And we're staying in a town called, oh, now I'm having a mental block, the hotel that was Eupen, E-U-P-E-N, Eupen, Belgium. And we were staying in a hotel called the Schmitzroth Hotel. Mm. And the person running the show was named Willie Shaw. He was a comedian from Chicago. And he knew Jimmy, later my husband, who was out there in the army, a GI, and he pulled strings to get Jimmy out of the army, saying, oh, this man should not be a foot soldier, he should be playing his horn. Mm. So that's what happened. Jimmy was pulled out of the front lines to come and be in special service. And that's how we met. And he was given a little, be the leader of a little band that would play in the hotel, which was like a rest area. And then he would join our group, and we would go out to the front lines. And sometimes we got strafed, and it was, you know, quite dangerous, but we didn't think anything of it at the time. And then we had a GI bass player and drummer, and Jimmy and myself. And so that's how Jimmy and I got together.
So that, how did it happen that that group was actually formed? I mean,
Well, this was a USO group. It was still under the auspices of USO camp shows.
So they didn't, but you already had a group.
Mm-hmm.
You already had a group, though, when his group came along.
Oh, this
or he
was...
he was added to your, the group?
He was added to the group.
I see.
Added to the group because he was not playing at the time.
He had been in
except Reveille, he would... About all he was getting to play was Reveille.
Reveille.
In fact, one of his little gimmicks was to play Reveille in Swing Time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he was almost arrested for doing that. He was told to stop doing that and play it straight. Anyway, that's how we got together. And it was interesting. I guess it was sort of a case of propinquity. We were there, you know, there we were, and we were sort of thrown together, and I started learning all these tunes from Jimmy and all his traditional... Well, I knew a lot of these traditional tunes.
Now, he, of course, for the benefit of those who don't know, was from the States.
From Chicago.
Yeah. And his background in the music, presumably he had grown up hearing that Chicago jazz.
Well, he was...
And the blues and everything.
Sure. And, I mean, he grew up with Louis Armstrong. They were pals. And... I'm trying to think of some of the other people.
So you
Rhythm
all,
Kings, the New
Rhythm
Orleans
Kings,
Rhythm
yeah.
Kings, and those mm-hmm. groups. And Jimmy had this little group, the Austin High School gang, himself and Bud Freeman, his brother-in-law Jim Lanigan, his brother Dick McPartland, Dave Tuff was in the thing. Because I didn't find all this out till later. I didn't realize
yeah.
Jimmy was sort of a big-time musician, and this ripple went through the whole camp there, or the whole town. Like, Jimmy McPartland's coming, Jimmy McPartland's coming. And I didn't really know anything about Jimmy. I guess I'm backtracking a little bit. And they had this huge party in a tent, like a jam session. They had an army band there, and they had a whole bunch of various musicians sitting in, and of course I wanted to be in that thing. I wanted to be there, and so Jimmy always tells how he saw me across the tent and said to himself, "Oh, I see a woman musician, and I know she wants to sit in." Or I think he even said, "A white woman musician, and I know she wants to sit in, and she'll probably be terrible." And then later he said to me, "And you were." I thought that was terribly unkind, because I really wasn't that bad. I think I wasn't keeping very good time. I think that was my big fault. But he liked my sense of harmony, so we sort of gravitated together, and that's how we came to get married over there.
And I guess you had a lot to talk about, because you were interested in the people that he had already known.
Yes.
And that whole experience he had come out of.
Of course, and I mean, to hear him dropping names like Louis Armstrong and Billie Holiday, people that I always listened to and wanted so much to meet,
yeah.
And Duke Ellington, and people that he obviously knew very well. It was very exciting.
So you married in what? Was that 44?
We married in 45.
45.
In Aachen, Germany, the military government.
You met in 44?
We met in 44.
Got married in 45.
45. And then he got his discharge over there, and he joined USO. And we had another show. I mean, through this period, we had several groups. And actually, we had guests in the show. One of the guests was Fred Astaire. And then another time we had Celeste Holm. And anyway, the whole thing, when the war was over, then we came back to the States.
So
April of 1946.
46, you came back.
Yeah, or at least it was.
Now, this was your first time coming to the States.
Yes.
Did you go to Chicago?
Because my parents had, by this time, given up, you know, decided I was no good. I'd married a musician. I'd done all the things I wasn't supposed to do.
You hadn't gone back to Guildhall and get those degrees.
No, and I'd married a musician, and my mother said, "Oh, you'll come to no good. You'll live in an attic." Which sort of was what happened maybe at first. So, we didn't go right to Chicago. We stayed in New York, and we went to clubs, and that's where I met Louis, and working in a club called The Aquarium on Broadway or someplace. And I met Gene Krupa, and we stayed at his house. And then we did go to Chicago. And Jimmy was offered a job to play at Eddie Condon's, which he turned down. Life might have been very different if he would have taken that job. He said, "No, I have to go to Chicago." So we went to Chicago, and we stayed there for 3 or 4 years. I'll have to... Maybe I should stop. I don't know how much of this you want to hear.
Well, I want to hear plenty of it. Did he have his own group right away when he came back? Did he form his own group?
What happened was we went to stay at his sister's house, and we didn't start working right away. I think, you know, Jimmy was always somebody that loved to sort of lay around, and of course in those days he had a pretty bad drinking problem, which I didn't know about, because I thought, well, the war is... he always used to say, "Oh, when I get back to the States, I don't do this, I'll drink like a gentleman," which in fact he didn't do. And so that sort of got in the way of things, because I don't think I probably did the best I could with it, but I was very upset with it. And we did eventually start a group, Jimmy and myself, bass player, a drummer, start working around.
Who were those, the bass player and the drummer?
First one we had, I think the first job we had an agent with MCA, was big in those days. And I think MCA booked this job, which was next to a bowling alley. It was called the Rose Bowl, and it was just a bar. And it's amazing how repercussions came from that place, because, let's see, who did we have in the band? We had Lou Finity was the drummer. Bass player was Ben Carlton. It was just a quartet at that time, Jimmy and myself.
And And how long did that go on?
Not too long.
I mean, was he? Why? Did he really think you were terrible? Did he really think that you couldn't keep?
No. I mean, no, not really. Oh. I mean, he just. I mean, I think he was, you know, trying to be funny. No, he actually, Jimmy turned out to be my best booster and great admirer. It seemed like everything I did. And he loved having me in the band because I guess I did catch on, knew all the tunes and learned to play in time and sort of to a certain extent keep him fairly straight.
Now, there are not very many instances in which a husband and wife are in the same band. I mean, of course, Louis and Lil Hardin,
There
was a period of time there. But it's not very often that happens.
No.
That has to be a very unusual and strange experience. It must have its pluses and its minuses, I would imagine.
Well, at that time, I was thinking, I mean, I felt great to be doing this. I never dreamed, I never had any plans to do this. Even after I married Jimmy, all I could think about was that I would work with him. I never had dreams of grandeur or anything what I was going to do. So Jimmy was always telling me, as time went on, he would say, you really should have your own group. I was starting to listen to bebop, and we were in France one time, and Jimmy was on a concert that had Miles Davis and Charlie Parker. I've got this wonderful poster at home. And anyway, he kept saying, you should have your own group. And I would go out to the South Side. We would finish a job. We'd go out and hear Red Saunders' band, who was a very fine drummer. And then we would hear Jackie Kroll and Charlie Ventura and Jackie and Roy, also out on the South Side. And then, of course, we worked at a place called the Blue Note, and we met Billie Holiday, who was Jimmy had worked with her, knew her, and all these exciting things were happening. And somewhere in there I met Duke. And anyway, I think it was about 1950 or thereabouts that we went to New York. And stopped in Philadelphia on the way there and played a place called the Rendezvous nightclub. And I only bring this up because I worked with people that I sort of admired and thought about who are now gone, like Sidney de Paris. Mm-hmm. Sat in for Jimmy one night. And I met Wilbur de Paris, and he worked in the band for a while. And Omar Simeon, clarinet player. He was just a lovely man. It was great having these people. Anyway, we went to New York, and then I did start working with my own trio.
All right, well, I want to stop and change tape, and then we'll take a short break, and then we'll pick up with when you started to branch out on your own.
I didn't know I was going to be babbling on like this.
No, this is not babbling. This is history. I wanted to ask you a little more about the interaction with Jimmy when you performed together, and then get into the beginnings of your branching out and having your own group. What was the audience response to this husband and wife with a couple of other people as a quartet? It was mostly a quartet, right?
It was sometimes a quintet, too.
Sometimes a quintet. Yeah. What kind of response did you get, both from the audience and from other musicians?
Well, of course, all the musicians, Jimmy's generation group, people that he knew, that we would see a lot of them. But the audiences were always great. Different from now, because now I find all the audiences are really quite respectful, and it's like it's almost like a concert everywhere. Mm. At least for me, I'm only speaking for myself. But years ago, you know, you're working in a nightclub, and there would always be noise. Somebody would be making noise. So, but the audiences were very, very responsive.
Did you find being English to begin with?
Yes.
Not being American, being female, not being male, how did the musicians deal with you in that respect? I mean, I presume most of them weren't accustomed to dealing with foreign female, foreign or female musicians. And I don't just mean the ones that you worked with, but those that you'd come in contact with when you were on the same bill with them playing somewhere. Was there much of a problem at all?
I don't remember any kind of a problem. Now, I mean, going back to myself and Jimmy, I think Jimmy, working with Jimmy, I was his wife, and I think it sort of put the stamp, good housekeeping stamp of approval on me, no matter what I was, English, white, a woman, whatever I was, which Leonard Feather neatly mentioned later on. I mean, if things were ever said, like maybe behind my back, who knows? Like, well, the man, the chick don't swing. And you might hear things, but I never heard anything like that. And I was always dying to improve and do better. And I was probably playing as well as I could. But when I listened to things I made, recordings made years ago, I mean, I know I have got better. But at the same time, it wasn't bad.
Yeah.
It wasn't all that bad. And I remember we started our own little label in Chicago, Unison Records. Hmm. And we had a sextet of people. I don't know if you need their names. Well, we still had Ben Carlton on bass. Jack, can't think of his name, on clarinet, who died. Oh, never mind. Mousy Alexander, who did make quite a name for himself, was the drummer. And we made this record. I remember laboring over a six-piece arrangement, one of the few I ever made, of Bix Beiderbecke, In a Mist. And it's not bad. It's really, really not bad, although I've found that very hard to do in recent years, do anything like that. I've stopped and let people do it for me. I never could get into arranging. I tried, but somehow that's not my thing. But anyway, you were talking about, of course, playing with Jimmy, we stayed more in the traditional group and old tunes, semi-standard tunes. If I Had You, It Had to Be You. Birth of the Blues, Jimmy liked to sing. And Jimmy had worked with Fats Waller, and he had a lot of stories about working with Fats and doing Ain't Misbehavin', because we did all those tunes. I think half the tunes we played I already knew before I got to America, including a lot of the traditional tunes. But then I started hearing all these bebop things, and after we went to France and stayed with Charles Delaunay, and then I heard Dizzy, and I was amazed. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I couldn't figure out how the piano player was playing what he was playing. And it sort of changed my life, and I started playing all these tunes like How High the Moon, and Jimmy went right along with like whatever I wanted to do, and I made a little sort of half-assed arrangement of How High the Moon and other things, and I started learning all those bebop tunes and trying to be a bebopper, which I guess I eventually became, in a sense. And then after we came to New York and I started with my own trio, which really, I have to say, I don't think I would have done any of the things that I have done if it wasn't for Jimmy sort of setting things up and being so proud of me and knowing all the people to talk to, and just helping me get started, because I was very green and callow when it came to having my own group. I didn't know how to be a leader. And he was, it was like a really a shield for me. He was doing all the talking, and he was very good at that, and singing, and I was just playing the piano.
But in some respects, playing the piano, you probably were a leader, not so much necessarily the leader of the band. It was his band, I guess.
Yes.
But you were leading the music in many respects, I presume.
Yeah, perhaps I was.
And is that possibly part of the reason why you wanted to branch out and have your own group, so that you could...
Well, it's funny. In the beginning, I didn't really want to. I was sort of comfortable in my niche and letting him be the front man and everything. I was comfortable with that. And then I would play a solo number or something during the evening. But then gradually, this idea sort of took hold with him saying, oh, you should have your own group. And then when I actually did start with the group at the Embers, it was the most amazing experience. This was around 1950, I guess, or 51. I'm not sure. And I don't know how I got these people, but I got Don Lamond on drums and Eddie Safransky on bass. And I was just a nervous wreck doing this. I've seen pictures of myself, and I think I looked sort of nervous, dressed up in sequins and beads. Anyway, the owner, Ralph Watkins, decided he wanted to beef up the group a little bit, because we were working opposite Eddie Haywood, and I guess we weren't, between the two of us, we weren't really filling the room, and nobody knew me. So Ralph Watkins brought in as guests Roy Eldridge and Coleman Hawkins. Mm. And Eddie Haywood didn't want to play for them. So needless to say, I was only too thrilled to have them play. So this was my wonderful experience there, to have them as guests. And they were so wonderful to me, and never, ever said, well, if I were you, I would play this, or if don't do that, or anything. They just were wonderful. And Roy always talked about that to the end of his days, about what a good time he had there. And he felt that I was, you know, by volunteering to... I guess he felt bad about Eddie Haywood not wanting to... He wanted to be the star, but, you know, I was only too thrilled to have... Anyway, I've got pictures of that, thank God.
You do?
Oh, yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so then that was that was the start of the trio thing. We had a remote radio program in there. And then I also had a radio program on what was then WNEW, 15 minutes.
AM, WNEW AM.
With Al Jazbo Collins.
Oh, Al Jazbo Collins, yes.
Yeah, and I still couldn't talk, and he would want me to say something. It was really hard for me to even say one sentence without getting a nervous wreck. But
he was such a clown at times.
He was.
I would think he would loosen you up a bit.
Well, you'd think so, but I was very tense. And Jimmy was always saying, be yourself, be yourself. Just be yourself. But I was trying to. Anyway, I opened at the Hickory House.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the start of everything, because we were then, Jimmy and I both were signed with Joe Glazer. And Joe Glazer said, well, if you play your cards right, you can be there for a month or two. And the thing just went well. I was there for a year. And then, of course, I did start to loosen up. And then I'd met, I guess I had already met Duke Ellington, but he liked to come there.
Now, what do you remember the most about Duke? I mean, if you had to summarize, either personally or professionally, I mean, there are people who were born after 1974 when Duke passed on, and depend upon people like yourself to get closer to that mysterious individual who I always thought was in some respects mysterious because he was such a legend already.
Did you know him?
I did not know him, no.
You met him?
I met him, I saw him, I never really met him. I had much more of a time with Mercer. I worked with Mercer on several projects. Never really met Duke, but saw him. And his, to me, his I don't know if it's because I was only born in 1947, so by the time
That's
I
right.
was already...
That's right, you were just a mere kid.
Yes, by the time I was born, he was already a major force in the world of music.
Sure.
So I grew up hearing his music in my parents' home. My father might put on Ravel's Bolero one moment and a Duke Ellington piece the next moment. So I had a pretty rich musical environment. But from my perspective, Duke was already a legendary figure. When I actually saw him, I saw him as a person who was overwhelming, and I don't know how much of that was the legendary figure. And when I say overwhelming, at the same time, he was also very approachable. He appeared to me to be very approachable.
Oh, yeah.
And very much a human being.
Very much so.
But that's a very different perspective when you're a kid. Different from someone like yourself who was an adult and actually was with him, you know, as a peer. So your impressions are very, very important to people listening to your recollections.
Well, of course, I guess I got to know him a little bit being in the Hickory House because he liked to come there. I mean, not so much for the music as the stakes and his press person, Joe Morgan. And Joe Morgan was, actually, Joe Morgan got me to do a lot of good things, which was, he really nagged me to do certain things, like make a Duke Ellington medley so that you could play all his tunes when he came in. And I did, in fact, do that. I used to see him come in and I would switch to some of his tunes. And I knew a lot of his tunes and I learned a lot of Billy Strayhorn tunes. Billy would also come in there at different times. But anyway, Duke would invite me over to the table and Evie would be there and maybe somebody else. And he would be sort of very charming, of course, and sort of flirting, and in those days I didn't really know how to deal with that. He would be cut a little piece off the steak and offer it to me on the end of the fork, and I would take it. And he was just very charming, but as you say, very approachable and very kind, because two or three times he got up and played. I would ask him if he'd play with the group. At that time I had Joe Morello on drums and Bill Crow on bass. And, you know, both good players. And then I would sit at the bar and listen while he played. Mm. In fact, one night he played something. And afterwards, you know, while he was up there on the bandstand, I said, "What's that?" And he said, kind of with that kidding way, or is that sort of half kidding, "Oh, it's called Night Creature," he says. Mm. And that was, in fact, something he wrote called Night Creature. Maybe he got the germ of it up there. I don't know. But anyway, I just found him very warm and friendly, and one time he gave me, in an oblique kind of way, very good advice. Like, one night he said to me, he was always telling me how good I sounded, one night he said to me, "Oh, you know, you play so many notes." And I know I've said this before, but it was really an impression on me that I thought he's trying to tell me something. Don't play so many notes. It finally dawned on me. And, different times, he would be at Birdland and I would go there, and it seemed like wherever I went, when I showed up, he would ask me to sit in, and I always did, couldn't resist. And I guess maybe towards the end of his life, or the last few years, he was playing at the Rainbow Grill, the Rainbow Room, I'm not sure. And Phoebe Jacobs had invited me to go for opening night, and I went. And I remember he had Joe Benjamin on bass. I remember that because he invited me up to play. And I said, "Oh, I've never played with Joe Benjamin before." And he managed to make something suggestive out of that. He had the whole band dying with laughing. Anyway, I'm sitting there. But he was like that. I mean, it was fun. And I remember one night going down to Birdland, and you could see who was coming down the stairs because it was very brightly lit. And I was walking down there to go into the club. And he was on the bandstand, and he says, "Oh, here comes Mary McPartland, that pulchritudinous purveyor of tonal zest. Oh, God, I've never heard anything like that before or since. I mean, I think what I loved was his way of speaking and his wonderful enunciation. I just think everybody should speak like Duke Ellington, yeah, and have his vocabulary. And when he started to get the book together, Music Is My Mistress, I remember reading parts of that and calling him on the phone and having quite a conversation about the book. And then the thing he did that was really nice was, I guess this was maybe the year he died, I was doing a big school program in Washington, D.C., and Billy Taylor and other people had helped get this thing together in which I and local musicians would try to educate the local kids in the different schools to know something about jazz or play jazz. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be a good idea to take some simple tunes like Sea Jam Blues or something that had a lot of repetition that they could play. And that was one of the tunes we worked on with little kids. Anyway, we were pretty far along in this thing when I thought it would be so nice to have Duke come down there. And I asked him if he would come. I think maybe I also spoke to Mercer. He was sick at that time. I guess everybody knew it, but he came to the school. This was in the early 1974. And Mercer came, and he had, I can't remember the guy's name, Rocky was in somebody?
Rocky is the drummer.
He was the drummer.
Yeah.
I should remember the bass player offhand. I can't think who it was. And he came to the school and played for about 300 or 400 kids and did all the things that I'd been showing them. And I mean, it was an experience like there was no other. Mm. And I mean, he was like he always was, as sick as he was. He just played until, you had to get him off.
Yeah.
He just loved playing so much.
Did you do any work with Louis Armstrong at all?
Yes. Wait a minute. No, not really work. Meeting him under many occasions, because he would come to places where I was playing with Jimmy different times.
Well, he's a person who could tell a joke or two.
I can think of a few. In fact, I may have mentioned this somewhere else, but this is a joke that Jimmy, an actual fact that Jimmy was telling me when he and Louis were young kids. And he invited Louis to his house in Chicago. And Jimmy was living with his mother, I guess. His parents were divorced. And Louis knocked on the door, and his mother opened the door, and she said, "Oh, Mr. Armstrong, how nice to see you. Would you like some tea?" And Jimmy heard her say, "Would you like some tea?" And he rushed out, thinking Louis might say, "Yeah, I wouldn't mind some pot or something." He was sure Louis was going to say the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So Jimmy rushed out and said, "Oh, Louis, come with me," and took him away very quickly into another room so that he didn't say something wrong in front of Jimmy's mother.
Yeah. Now, in your experiences with Louis, what would you say to those people who never met him and who, because of seeing certain films, think that he was much more of a clown than a serious... Well, I mean, people know he's a serious musician, but at the same time, some people have thought of him as a clown without really having any real sense of who he was as a human being.
Well, because all the occasions I met him, it was a combination of both things. I mean, he was a very warm person, a very straight ahead, wonderful guy, great sense of humor, and I think the fact that he did the things that people disapproved of, like singing Hello Dolly and those things. I mean, he had a great sense of show business and what people liked, and I think for anybody to think that was the wrong thing to do, to sing some of those songs. Oh, what else? Blueberry Hill. And I mean, anything he sang was wonderful. And the fact that there was humor in it, I think there's not enough of that.
Yeah.
In music, and to sort of take it as, well, he's not dignified, or he's being an Uncle Tom, or all these different things. It's ridiculous to say that. I mean, look at what an ambassador he was in other countries. And it's amazing, like, he had such an allegiance to Joe Glazer. He felt that Joe Glazer had put him on the map and helped him. And I mean, Joe Glazer had done that, but just the same, I mean, Louis was the most straightforward and faithful guy where Joe Glazer was concerned.
Now, speaking of ambassadors, you, more than most, have been an ambassador. People like yourself and Billy Taylor and a few others have done more to educate the world about this music than virtually anyone else,
that's quite a compliment. I'm not sure if I can.
Well, you see, when you have a program like Piano Jazz, let's talk about Piano Jazz.
Oh well, yes. Well,
because you, through that program, you have reached, I don't know how many radio stations it's on.
200 right,
and
now.
Plus it's on some European stations as well.
Yes,
in Canada.
Is. Yeah.
So you are, and you do it in a way that in which you entertain, but you also give so much rich information, because you're not only performing, but you're in conversation with these people.
True.
So you have to be given credit for, I mean, people talk about your technique and your ability to give good performances and so on, but the way that you've been able to, through Piano Jazz, disseminate information about this music and entertain people at the same time is extraordinary and deserves only the highest praise. We, of course, were fortunate to have you here on this very stage with Jerry Allen.
Oh, I love doing that.
On the 8th of October, 1995.
Yeah, right.
And have that program recorded to be broadcast as it was nationally and internationally as part of the Piano Jazz series. There are several things that occurred to me as I sat and observed it, you know, because it's one thing to hear it on radio all the time. When you sit and you observe it and you know you're documenting it on videotape for the historical record, it becomes an even more important thing. One of the things I want to ask you about that you did that day, you paid tribute to Jerry Allen, your guest, by creating a piece of music in her honor, which I forget what you called it, a portrait of Jerry. Do you do that for many of your guests?
I feel I can do it. I'll tell you how that started. Years ago, when I first started the show, maybe the first year of the show, I had Chick Corea as a guest, and he did that. He said, oh, I think I'd like to do a portrait of you. And I was sort of taken aback, and I made a few jokes about it. Well, if you're going to do that, leave my nose out of it and things like that, and made a few jokes. And so then I thought, what a good idea. And so then I did one. I said, well, I'll do one for you, Chick. So I did that, and that sort of started me off. And then when somebody came that I felt I could sort of see something about their character that I could transmit into a musical language, then I would do it. I've done quite a few of them. I remember Teddy Wilson. I did something there, Carmen McRae.
Is it generally spontaneous? Or
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Totally spontaneous.
It's not just something that you're creating based upon what you've known about their music. It's a combination of that plus the interaction that you're in the process of having with them.
Yeah, it's sort of maybe even thinking about the character of the person. Are they amusing and sort of high-strung or funny? Or, like, I remember I did one for Dudley Moore, and just thinking about the kind of guy he is sort of made me know what kind of a piece I would play. Mm. The same with Jerry. I see just what a wonderful, staunch person she is, with these great musical ideas and very ambitious, straight ahead, and a very sweet person. So all this I'm sort of thinking about while I'm trying to play something.
Mm-hmm. What is the origin of piano jazz? How did it come about?
Well, Alec Wilder, who I'm sure you know, he and I became great friends, and he wrote a lot of short piano pieces for me, and he had this show on National Public Radio when his book came out, American Popular Song, which I'm sure you have a copy of. Mm-hmm. What a book. And as a result of bringing out that book, NPR asked him to, ETV, people in South Carolina wanted him to do a show using the songs from that book. So he had people like Tony Bennett, Margaret Whiting, Joe Williams, you name it, he had them as guests. And so this was his series, which went on for maybe a year or two. Really not that long, and then that ended. So they were looking around for something. They thought they'd like to have something to follow that. So then somebody approached me and said, could you come up with something similar to what Alec had?
And what was the name of his?
It was called American Popular Song.
American Popular Song, yeah.
And they didn't know what they wanted, really. They wanted something that was entertaining, it was educational, had music in it, conversation. So I thought having two pianos would be the easiest thing for me. I wouldn't have to be scurrying after recalcitrant bass players or drummers, trying to find the drummer I wanted. So two pianos, this is going to make it. So we started, and they had no money. They paid everybody, but they didn't have big money for a studio or anything. So we did the show out of the Baldwin Piano Showroom in New York. And Jack Roman, who was with Baldwin, unfortunately he died later on, he helped us get the thing started. And some of the best shows that I did on piano jazz were done in the Baldwin showroom, like picking out two pianos and pulling them up side by side. Mm. We had Hazel Scott, Billy Taylor, Ubi Blake, Albert Daly, Mary Lou Williams. She was the first one. Boy, I was a nervous wreck.
Mary Lou was the first one?
Yeah. She was my first guest, but they didn't. She was not the first show, I think.
She wasn't the first one to air.
No, I think Billy Taylor was the first one to air.
When was this?
This was 1979. Mm-hmm. We had Bill Evans.
Why were you nervous with the Mary Lou?
Hmm?
Why were you nervous with the Mary Lou Williams?
Well, Mary Lou was a very strong person, as you know, and she could speak her mind and be... And she would get rather snippy with me at times. I think she got mad at me, but... I mean, I've always thought we were good friends, and in fact, she wrote a lot of her pieces out for me, which I still have at home. And I think she may have been a little annoyed at me for being the one that had piano jazz and not her. And in fact, she said something like that to the producer, and he said, well, Mary Lou, you're the guest, you know, well, she said something rather, I don't know what she was, and we thought it was going to be two pianos. She brought a bass player, Ronnie Boykins. And anyway, the show was all right, but she sort of mellowed after a while. In fact, she sang a song, and she could be very charming and nice, and she was. We all went to the Russian Tea Room and had a sort of celebratory dinner afterwards. And actually, I should have brought that one today for you, but I couldn't find it. I'll send it to you. And anyway, we did the show. That got us started, and so then I was like a kid in a candy store. Who will I get? I'm calling up everybody. John Lewis, Bill Evans. Oh, I think I said Teddy Wilson.
Well, how many people have you had on so far now?
I'm not sure. I've lost count. I think maybe about 300.
I would think it must be by now.
We've had a few repeaters, but very few. I mostly try to get more people, and we sort of branched out and had horn players. Like we had Winton a couple of times, and Branford Marsalis, and Ellis Marsalis, And I've had Bobby Short, I've had George Shearing, of course, two or three times. And
you know, in the famous photograph that was in Esquire magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Weren't you standing next to Mary Lou?
Yes.
I thought so. I just had that image in mind.
Well, it's funny because we sort of gravitated together when this mob of people were assembling there. You're sort of looking out for somebody you know and you can talk to.
Yeah.
Or that you were friendly with. I mean, I think I probably did know everybody. But I was sort of shy around people like Lester Young. I don't know. I knew them all, but I kind of felt that they were in a different realm than myself. But Mary Lou I was very friendly with. And I had Oscar Pettiford on the other side who used to come to the Hickory House and sit in a lot.
And you went back, was it earlier this year or was it last year that the group came back together? It must have been...
With whom?
There was another photograph taken.
Oh, yes, for Life magazine.
For Life magazine.
Huge photo taken.
That was last year, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, but I don't... As good as that is, I don't think it had the actual feeling that first one had. There was a different feeling in the air
then. So few people that
the
were
whole,
still there.
Then when they took that second picture of just those of us that were left, I mean, that's a very poignant picture.
Yeah. And you said you went in the same positions that you had been in,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
That was a very...
And even since then, we've lost Jerry Mulligan?
Yes, he was there in that picture.
Yeah.
That's probably the last conversation I had with him, sort of kidding around.
Gene Bach, who made the film A Great Day in Harlem, based on that picture. Did you know that Milt Hinton had his camera there that day?
Oh,
everyone knew it?
Yeah, I did know, but I didn't think anything of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a damn good job he did. This would probably be no film.
Yeah.
And he had his wife Mona shooting away like mad.
Right. And then Gene was able to gather many of the folks who had been there and interview them at different points along the way, Dizzy Gillespie and so many other people, to make that fabulous film, A Great Day in Harlem. We've just gotten from her, by the way, the outtakes, all of the raw footage, not outtakes, the actual raw footage of all those interviews.
Because oh, really? Because he's starting to do a second one.
Yes, that's right.
In fact, he did another interview with me to be used in that.
Yes.
So if she's got as good stuff as she had in the first one, I don't see why there couldn't be a sequel.
Yeah, there should be. She originally wanted to do 4 hours. I remember going a few years ago and visiting. I've known Gene for about 20 years, and I remember going in and looking at the footage and just you just had to feel so badly that 58 minutes is such a hard and fast rule with many things in television, unless you've got something that the Civil War you can do 12 hours or whatever that was, and Roots you can do 12 hours, but unfortunately with something like A Great Day in Harlem, when you've got people like Dizzy and all the other folks, yourself and all the others who were giving recollections not only of that day but of the music itself, of this treasure, this American treasure, that Representative John Conyers has even gotten the Congress to recognize officially, and you still have to limit it to 58 minutes for television.
Yeah. Well, if she can come up with another 58 minutes, it'll be all good. Maybe she can just keep on doing that, because I think people that didn't know anything about jazz were extremely interested in the film. I think a lot of people just didn't know what the people were like until they heard them speak.
Yeah.
And of course, Dizzy and Art Blakey and all the different people that Bud Freeman did. And listening to them speak and talk about their experiences was very edifying to me. I mean, empathizing with a lot of the things they were talking about. I was very proud to be in that picture. I was very thrilled. And I was sorry that Jimmy didn't make it. And he didn't make it because he was too lazy to get up. And I guess people thought he was drinking, but he had long since joined AA and was not drinking. But he just, if I'd known it was going to be such an important thing, I would really have made him get up, but I didn't. I just said, well, I'm going. I always
wondered how many people even at that time, could have known how important that photograph was going to be. It's not so, I mean, I guess it's just the idea that, first of all, that was really the golden age of jazz in many respects.
It was, yeah.
And to be able to assemble all of those people in one place, just the fact that you look at such a photograph and see all those faces and immediately can think of all the music that these folks represent, all the culture that these people represent. I don't know how anyone could have imagined how important it would become, but of course it was great that Esquire magazine had the foresight to even do that issue. And you know, the photographer who did that, Art Kane, was not really a photographer. He was a graphics artist or something,
right.
A graphic artist, and he was asked to come up with a cover for the magazine, and they expected him to come up with some great graphic or something, some cover art, and he, not being a photographer, had decided, let me do something with the photograph, and so it was not to be expected at all. He, by the way, tragically committed suicide after the release of the film.
It's funny, we were at the party that was given after the movie.
Oh, you were at that party?
I was at that party, oh. And Art Kane gave me a big hug, and he looked very happy and excited and said how wonderful it was. And you wonder what possesses somebody to go after that and be sort of at the height of their career almost, have done something so wonderful. What can be in the human spirit that would make him go?
Well, then you start to think that it must have been a very, very horrible life that he was living in reality that we all didn't see. Although, on the other hand, and I don't know that anyone really knew that the film was going to become such a big thing either.
Maybe not. But
I only thought so because I have such great appreciation for Gene Bach, and I got to see the film in various stages of development, and knowing a little of the history of the photograph. But it was almost as though this should be a time when Art Kane would really come into his own. He could be on some of the speaking engagements now. People would have a whole new appreciation for him. And it is tragic that he wasn't such.
Because he could have given so much to other people.
Yeah. And
although his talking in the film was so funny, I mean, about how trying to get all of us together with a rolling up a newspaper with a megaphone. I remember everybody was milling around like a bunch of kids, and we didn't know what was going to happen. I guess I just was. Nat Hentoff came to the Hickory House, that's how I got in it. He sort of, like a messenger running from door to door, came in and said, oh, this picture's being taken tomorrow, and if you want to be there, be up in Harlem at 10 o'clock. And at 10 o'clock, oh my goodness. So anyway, it's great to see such a positive thing happening for jazz, because usually that kind of thing happens for rock musicians, of people that really,
that's right.
I hate to say it, but are not worthy of that kind of attention. And all those people up there, everyone should know who those people were and are.
That is the, as many people have said, it's America's classical music. And it does not get its due. For whatever reason, it's much more easy to make a commercial success out of music that is much less complex, much less intimate. You know, I have talked to young folks several times since the electronic advances, quote-unquote, in the making of sound recordings. I like to point out at times to them that when you got a Duke Ellington record or a Marion McPartland record or a Dizzy Gillespie or Louis Armstrong record, you know that what you're listening to really happened one day. It actually happened just that way. Today, when they buy their music, they don't know if the artists who are on that CD ever faced each other.
I never thought of that. That's true. Somebody's doing it in California and putting down tracks in New York. And
get a machine to lay down a rhythm track, and then one person's doing theirs in one state, someone else in some other country. And then the remix engineers and the producers have more to do with what the ultimate piece is going to sound like than the musicians themselves.
You know, I never thought of that, but isn't that interesting that when you make a jazz recording, the people are all there, they're doing it at that time.
It really happened.
It really happened, and it still does. I mean, you still do it that way.
Yeah.
You still do it with with all the people there at this one occasion, recording the music.
And we have a generation of people growing up listening to music, with walking around with the Walkman on half the time, and listening to something that never really happened.
That's fascinating. I'll never forget you said that, because it's...
And then they'll wonder why, when they go to a concert, it's not quite as great. I mean, there's often much more excitement about the culture that's grown up around the music that's been manufactured than about the actual experience. It's not like going into a club and sitting and watching 4 or 5 or even 10 or even a 16 or 17 piece orchestra of people working together and interacting together. That's an experience that's being lost, unfortunately. Obviously not in all situations, but in many, and we have a generation or two that's lost the experience of knowing what it's like to experience the interaction among musicians. It's a real concern, and
I just keep thinking about like jam sessions and things of being in a club and having people come in and sit in. I don't know what made me think of that, but I guess that's sort of a thinking of some things that happened, like a one time only.
Yes.
Being in Bradley's, and Charles Mingus was there, and I sat in. And, I mean, that's something I'll never forget, playing with that guy in a club. I guess. Well.
Now, you've done some writing as well. I mean, you've piano jazz, I have to say, though, I think piano jazz is... and now with CDs of piano jazz out...
That pleases me very much.
That is just... Well, this does mean that it will be preserved, and it does mean that those who have missed the NPR radio broadcasts will have an opportunity to grab a CD and take it home and learn and enjoy there. A couple of other things. You've done work with school children. You started to mention one of those earlier. You have a particular interest in school children and in exposing them to the music?
Yeah, just... Well, I guess it happened years ago. I'm sure I wasn't the first one to do it, but I think it started maybe in the late 50s or early 60s, and playing in a club. In fact, I know where it started, in Rochester, New York, and I was playing at a place called Joe Squeezes. It was a nightclub in Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
And a disc jockey there, who was quite well known, Will Moyle, came around and asked me if I would go and play in the school where his kids were. And I said, well, I don't think they'd like to hear what we play, like, you know, stomping at the Savoy, whatever we were doing at that time. Oh, yes, they would. So that was my first school experience, playing for these kids in Rochester, and Joe Morello. And I think the bass player at that time was Bill Brito. And we went and we played and were received with great enthusiasm, and I think they were just happy to be let out of algebra. I think that's the reason they liked it so much. At any rate, I said to the audience, well, what would you like to hear us play? And as if with one voice, they all yelled, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. And I was amazed, and you know, that started me on wanting to play in schools jazz for kids. I thought, it's amazing that that's what they think is great music, or that's what they all listen to. So that's when we started doing dates in schools, and not for any money. I would just be playing a concert or something, or a club date in a town, and I would get in touch with the local, somebody at a school, and say, can we come over and do a concert for you? We would just go there and do them for free and hope that we got some publicity with them. And so that's how that whole thing started, and then gradually we did a program out in Long Island for about 10 weeks doing things in schools. That was the first one. And then we just kept on doing it, and of course there were all these other people, Billy Taylor with Jazzmobile, probably got that whole thing started. Then various other things, and then this big project in D.C., and I'm still doing occasional dates at a college or a school. In fact, I do one every year where I live at Port Washington with the high school band. And
they must love you out there.
Well, actually, I don't know. They're sort of kids that listen to rock, and we've sort of gradually got them interested in jazz. There's a very good band director named Dave LaLama, and he comes over and kind of whips them into shape. And we play anything from Lester Leaps In to various. Really, I mean, they're getting there, getting better. And I play with the band, and then we bring out the trio, and then I play two pianos with Dave, and we do this every year. We've put we've made cassettes of the band so the kids can hear themselves.
By the way, did you play Hound Dog for those kids that time?
No, I didn't. I didn't even know how, if it had any sort of a melody. I mean, it doesn't have much, I'm sure.
It's an old boogie woogie blues kind of blues.
Is that where that
song
came from?
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, it predates Elvis by,
I guess,
quite a while.
Oh, I'm sure, but I'm sure that Elvis, I mean, it seems he took all those old blues players' tunes and played them.
Well, you know, it's not so much that he did it. It was done through him, because the people who were the money people had made the determination that since the radio stations had said, well, the advertisers won't advertise if we play rhythm and blues. So the story goes that Colonel Tom Parker, who was the person who discovered Elvis, made a statement that if I could find a white kid who could sing black, I'd make $1 million.
Oh, really?
And that was
that's
was Elvis.
That's how that started.
Because Elvis used to be, I mean, he learned from the stevedores, he learned from sitting in the Apollo Theater in the front row. He learned a lot of stuff from the blues and the rhythm and blues people. In fact, Alan Freed, who had a very popular radio program playing rhythm and blues music in the early 50s, called it the Moondog Mad Dog Rock and Roll House Party. But what he was playing was the rhythm and blues, which of course all grew out of jazz and blues, because you had people like Louis Jordan playing all that boogie woogie 8-to-the-bar stuff, and that all is where that all evolved into what Chuck Berry and Little Richard and eventually Elvis Presley were doing.
Yeah, well, I remember listening to all that music in Chicago, and there was a station I listened to all the time, and I'm trying to think of the guy's name, I can't remember, but at that time it was called Race Music.
Yes.
That's the name of it. But I didn't even understand what that meant. I just listened to it all with great enjoyment, you know. And then
they called it race music because it's music by people of the race, and the race was the other race.
Then it went to rhythm and blues, or
that's right.
It just changed names,
but
it's the same kind of thing.
That's exactly right.
And you know, it's all wonderful music.
One other thing, you've done some writing.
You mean writing?
Writing of articles and books, even.
Yes.
What have you written?
Nothing of any great length. I find writing very difficult, although the end result, I'm always happy to see that. I remember I did a piece of Art Tatum once, or actually it was just a piece for a newspaper after he died, and I articles. I've done a lot of articles and for Downbeat and did one for Esquire and different places, and they've all been consolidated into a book called All in Good Time. But that's mostly what I've done. I've done some liner notes. An album that Jimmy and I made, I wrote the liner notes, and as I say, the end result is great, but doing it is sheer agony. And I'm trying to write a whole like a biography, and I've got tons of research. And if, when I sit down with somebody like yourself, I can just talk like crazy. But if I sit at home in front of a tape recorder, it doesn't work. It's like I have to have feedback. But I'm trying. I hope I can get it done.
Well, writing music, I presume, comes a lot more naturally and without so much resistance.
Well, sometimes, you know, I mean, sometimes you can write something in about 10 minutes. The piece, I had a nice piece that Thad Jones and Mel Lewis recorded called Ambience, which I think I was sort of influenced by hearing Herbie Hancock recordings of that time, and I mean, I didn't copy it, but sort of, I don't know, anytime I'm in a school with kids or doing a stage band clinic or something, I'd always write something. I think they inspire me to write. So then I wrote Ambience in Norman, Oklahoma. And Pat Metheny was in the band. He was about 15 at the time. And I wrote a piece just recently. And then I wrote piece for Mary Lou Williams was on the record that we made of her music. And I'm trying to continue to do more pieces.
Well, I'd love to have you grace our stage with anything that you feel like doing.
Mean play something?
Yes, if you don't mind.
Well, I could maybe play the piece I wrote for Mary Lou.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
Could do that.
Sure. And that will let that... That'll be our closing prayer then.
Okay.
More or less.
Our closing prayer that the music will continue to be heard by more people, and that all the kids coming up that are playing jazz will become great and will keep the thing going forever. That's what we hope.
That's what we hope. That's one of the reasons that we're doing this.
Yes, but it's a great thing that you're doing. We appreciate being a part of it.
Well, we couldn't have done it without your being a part of it, frankly. We're very pleased that you're, even though you have not revealed your age.
We'll have you'll find it out somehow.
Record.
They always do.
Oh, I know it. I just won't mention it right now since you've
no,
asked us not to.
It's just such a shock, you know. It's like, it's just too shocking. I just want to keep up the charade.
Just keep going, right?
You know.
But we are just very happy that you're still with us and will continue to be with us. You look like you're going strong. Every time I see you, you look...
Yeah, I'm lucky I have my health and strength, and that's the main thing.
And you've got a good sense of humor and a great gift at the keyboard still. I think there's an article in Today's Times, I haven't seen it yet, but someone told me about it, that talks about hand problems that musicians come up with. And to be able to have had such a long career and still be able to perform has got to be a blessing.
Well, see, I have hand problems, but somehow playing... seems to help. I mean, I've never ever given in to any hand problem.
Yeah.
I just sort of think, well, I'll just play harder. And
it's part of the therapy.
And it seems to work.
Well, Mary McPartland, thank you very much. And I look forward to hearing now a little taste of your tribute to Mary Lou.
This is called Threnody. I'm sort of a word snob. And I wanted a word that meant something sad and melancholy without using those same words. And threnody, I found out, is a word that means like a melancholy song, a wailing kind of song.
I see. So, and how do you spell it?
Threnody.
Threnody.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a real word. I didn't make it up.
Uh-huh. Okay.
All right. What do? You cut this down to size afterwards?
Oh, no, we'll keep all of this.
Oh, you're kidding.
This is for the historical record.
Oh, my God.
Thank you. I'm sure Mary Lou is smiling.
Oh, I don't know. She's probably saying, oh, why did you play that card? Well, if I were you, you should have done it this way, as it should usually say.